Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Administrative Remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks hanging up that might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. So essentially how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. gives you zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then I will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air so long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them. you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you file board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right. Lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedies in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we're going to disclose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very, very much for that disclaimer. We appreciate you. Sincerely, we do. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about something. Brother John is here to talk about something that is often, sadly, overlooked to both the chagrin and detriment of your case, and that is keeping good records of everything, even the minor stuff. You'd be shocked how important it is to resurrect something that you thought was innocuous in the beginning, but proves to be so fatal to their cause, the opposing counsel's cause, years later. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to this evening to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Well, thank you for that very kind and gracious introduction, both Martin and Michael. Thank you both. Michael's point about, and I'll call it just paperwork for the moment, can sometimes be so shockingly much stronger than he's made it tonight that it would almost curl your teeth. To that end, when you have everything from a court case,
thank you for this little entertainment tonight, ladies and gentlemen. I apologize that there was a little glitch with the recording. I could not get it off until this moment. Tonight, we are blessed with a live call with Brother John. And out of this live call, we're going to be talking about something very, very important. He's going to be sharing with us, teaching with us tonight, the proper preparation for pleadings and a complaint. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Brother John. Go ahead, buddy.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for that kind and gracious introduction there. That's very kind of you, both Martin and Michael.
Screwing up with the recording, it happened.
Well, like they say in Texas, oil well. When you talk to someone, first thing you need to do is you need to get their attention. You need to address them. You know, if I'm going to talk to Michael, I'm going to say, "Hey, Michael, do you have a moment?" It's the same way in pleadings. We're going to talk about how you put a pleading together or anything or just to a simple motion to the case. You identify who you're talking to and who you are. When you call up somebody on the, on a helpline or a help desk or anything and you need attention, you always let them know who you are and find out who they are. That's the first part of every pleading. There's something called a style, and it's spelled S-T-Y-L-E. And that is, it has the case information in it. First of all, it has the court or the jurisdiction in with which you're seeking attention. And on the left side, it has both parties. It has the pleading or the plaintiffs first, and then the defendants second on the left side. Then on the right side, it identifies once you've been assigned a cause number, a case number, and in certain courts, they like the title of that particular pleading or motion in that, and sometimes the judge's name on the right side. And then then comes a teeny bit of controversy. Some individuals say that, I don't want to yield to this court's jurisdiction. If you're a defendant, then there may be some value in that. And you say, comes now John Michael Smith by special appearance, meaning that I'm not actually yielding to the authority of the court, but I'm here anyway, and I'm not setting it up. But if you're a plaintiff and you're seeking an action in a court, then you're expecting that court to recognize that they have jurisdiction to hear your complaint. And to that end, you won't make a special appearance. You won't appear by special appearance on those, because if you don't give them the authority to hear your case, and if you don't tell them that they have the authority, then they don't. And to that end, many cases have been simply dismissed because they didn't have jurisdiction, and jurisdiction was never established. And the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, it's very clear that that you define that they have jurisdiction. And more specifically, in the different paragraphs that ensue, you will tell them, comes now John Michael Smith, here and after known as plaintiff, and would ask the court to grant the following relief. My neighbor's dog, he comes over and he bites, and I've been bit many, many times, and I would like an injunction and a restraining order against the neighbor, and for the following good and sufficient reasons, would show the court the following. And when you prepare your pleading, first you tell them what you're going to tell them, then you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. I'll say that again. First, you tell them what you're going to tell them. You tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. And then, in closing, you ask for relief. But what it happens is that the next paragraph, you're going to do just that. You're going to say, on such and such a date, the defendant, his dog came over, and this date his dog came over, and we've been bit three times, and the reference exhibits A, B through F, the doctor's bills and the police reports that have been filed against the defendant for his dog coming over to our property. And his dog has knocked down the pickets, four of the pickets in the fence, and chewed up this property and that property, and you're going to explain to them what all of the you're going to go through and begin to explain that what's what they've done to you. And then you're now Rule 12B6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure requires that you state a claim for which relief can be granted. If you cannot state a relief for which, or claim for which relief can be granted, then the court has no business listening to you. Hang on, just send him to get something to drink. Thank you. Throat was getting a little dry there. if the court needs three things for to be able to grant a relief. They need to have in personam jurisdiction, meaning that jurisdiction over you and the other party. They need to have subject matter jurisdiction, meaning that the topic is something that is within the jurisdiction of that court. If you're asking for $1 million settlement, you can't go to Justice of the Peace Course, which has a maximum of $10,000 or $20,000 or $100,000. If you're asking for judgment over an accident that happened at sea, there's certain maritime courts that have jurisdiction over that. You won't get that from the local superior court or the Justice of the Peace. That's a maritime law, and maritime law is covered in a different way, with different jurisdiction, different courts. When you go to these people, you will have to give them in personam jurisdiction. You will have to confirm that they have subject matter jurisdiction, meaning that it's something that they can work with, and then you will have to confirm to them that they have territorial jurisdiction, meaning this is within the territory of the boundary layers. This court only has jurisdiction within this county or this city. Is this a city court or a county court? Or maybe it's a state court. And maybe you're going to Oklahoma to make a pleading, but the event occurred in Kansas. They don't have territorial jurisdiction. When you're suing an individual, you're required to go to the jurisdiction of that individual resides in or the business is in, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And if you had a mail order, you ordered a mail order bride out of New York, and you live in Washington, and and you ordered seven brides, and you've got six brothers, and they only sent five brides, and it's out of a mail order house in New York, you have a little bit of a challenge. The difficulty with you is, even though you're in Washington, you have to go to New York. Now, because this is interstate, not intrastate, now you no longer can do it at the state level. You must do it at the federal level. Now you're going to sue this XYZ company out of New York in U.S. District Court, federal court, which transcends all the jurisdictions, so that you can get all seven brides for all seven brothers. In the meantime, the ones that are with intrastate jurisdiction or intra-county or intra-city, meaning it's within this city's jurisdiction, you can go to the city court or the JP court or the county court. If it's all within the state of Arizona, then you can go, and you're in Maricopa County, then you can get justice and territorial jurisdiction in Maricopa County. But going back, there's three things. You have to have in personam jurisdiction, meaning that you give them your personal jurisdiction, meaning that they have the right to make a ruling over you. They have to have subject matter jurisdiction, meaning that it's a topic that has not been assigned to another court or another jurisdiction, but it is readily adjudicatable in their court, and then you must have territorial jurisdiction. Okay, and these things, although a lot of individuals don't seem to have a problem with not listing them, it's still very important that you make a paragraph for each one of those that you say venue or territorial jurisdiction, etc., and you identify the different jurisdictions that are that I'm a resident of Maricopa County. The court is in Maricopa County, Arizona. The car was stolen from me and stripped down in Maricopa County, and therefore the Maricopa County Superior Court has jurisdiction, okay, in Arizona. You tell them that. If they have to go looking for jurisdiction and sort it out, there are times when the judge will not even waste the time or take the time searching to determine if he has subject matter jurisdiction or territorial jurisdiction or in personam. If you don't define it there and prove it to them in advance, you may not have your case. Your case may not be heard. Okay. So what happens is that we're going to serve them up on a platter the information that we need that they need to be able to say, this is I can do that. This is something that I can rule on. We want to give that to them up front. Then we go ahead and give them all the facts. You know, the dog keeps biting on this and that date, and reference exhibits A through E, the doctor bill and F through Q, the police reports, reference exhibits R through Y, the damage, the property damage, how many times I've had to have the pickets replaced. This dog stands 5.5 hands high. It's not a dog. It's a honking horse. And it just comes barreling at my fence and destroys the fence every single time. I've got a place where it damaged my front bumper because it hit it head on with its own head. And it just hit the bumper on my car. You know, but you have all those exhibits. Okay. Then what happens is that special circumstances that need to be addressed are now addressed there. That, this only happens during certain hours, et cetera. If there's something referenced in a specific police report, reference that. Car theft occurred within a special jurisdiction, meaning maybe it was stolen from the parking lot of a federal agency or it was stolen on private property. It was stolen from within your garage that maybe in Maricopa County they had to trespass to steal the car. So now there's extra circumstances. And you have to explain those. Okay, after you complete your complaint and you're explaining all of these special circumstances that also go with it and the evidence to go with it. Now, evidence to go with something sometimes is very cumbersome to put the evidence in directly into a pleading. So what we do is we always put that in as an exhibit. We offer an exhibit, and exhibits are just straight evidence. There's one thing that you do not want to do with an exhibit. Not intentionally, unless you've got a really good reason. An exhibit is straight evidence. It's photos. It's a receipt. It's a copy of this police report. It's a affidavit that's a statement of facts. Now, when it comes to statements of facts, what happens is that that has something that has to be sworn to. An affidavit qualifies as testimony and evidence that you enter into the record. An affidavit cannot have conclusions. You cannot make summary or conclusions in an affidavit. If you're going to summarize or make conclusions, there better be an awful good reason, and know that the judge is probably going to disqualify it from being entered into the record. There are some times when I have entered an affidavit fact into the record knowing that the judge was going to disqualify it. And I did it so that the judge would know all the facts personally, because there was no other easy way to demonstrate those facts to that judge. And sure enough, one of them that was less than a year ago wrote an affidavit for that explained the response to some horrendous, abominable accusations and this case that this individual filed against somebody else over a tractor. You know, it was just unbelievable. The facts in the affidavit that I propounded, I debunked almost everything for the other party, for the defendant, that this gentleman who was coming against him, the plaintiff, had said, well, there was this and there was that and there was that. And I included in my affidavit exhibits, attachments to that affidavit that showed all of the lies and all of the facts. And I knew that the judge was probably going to disqualify that as entering it into evidence. At the same time, the judge ended up, without giving a reason, he says we're not going to accept the affidavit of John in the of Servant John in the case here. And then 2 days later, he dismissed the cause of action and gave the gentleman 30 days to refile. It had its effect, but there was a reason. At the time when we put that on, at the time when I submitted that affidavit, that I had, there were three places where there were conclusions made, that, and I made the statement, well, if this is actually the fact here, then the individual would have had to have had one of these three mindsets, etc. And in every case, everyone was wrong, you know, for the actions that were committed. And I wasn't stating facts. I was drawing the judge to help make conclusions. And that was something that me as an affiant, I could not technically do. Only the parties in the case can do that. Now, the party in the case, he could have easily, you know, filed something with that affidavit. Had I been able to coordinate with him and take the time to instruct him, etc., and I would have definitely done it that way. But we had neither the time nor the capacity. What happens is that you now include all the evidence to support all the statements that were made and all the claims that you made and the allegations. And then as you get down toward the continuance of the pleading, then what you do is sometimes you'll reference other court cases that, and this is where case law comes in, and they call the term shepherdizing, as in shepherd that goes out in the pasture for the sheep, and or a shepherd of a religious organization, a pastor. But the term shepherdize, and what that means is that you find all the related cases that have been ruled upon that have similar rulings to the outcome that you're looking for. Because remember, not every case that's weighed and ruled upon that has the facts similar to what you're considering will have the outcome that you're looking for. In fact, you need to be prepared for receiving quite the opposite, where you end up finding out that all of a sudden half the cases out there, only half of them ruled like you were hoping. The other half were ruled completely the opposite direction, and that's no good. You know, so what happens is that they call it a case law, what happens is that as you address that, you help the judge lean on the opinions of other judges, and you try to pick the most prominent ones first. Hold on for a moment. Sorry, thank you for your patience. Got another little sip of my Gatorade here. But what happens is that now that you've given the court an overview of your case, first you told them who you are, who you're talking to, and who you're talking about. You gave the court the jurisdiction. You identified you gave them in personam jurisdiction. Then you identified that they either have subject matter or territorial jurisdiction by direct statement. Then you told them the relief you were seeking from them, that you're seeking, and you did that either up front or now in the pleading, and you can do it at either one. He says, I'm seeking a temporary injunction and permanent restraining order against the neighbor for his dog, and we show the court the following. You bought that up, and now you're giving the giving the complaint and the facts to go with it, and now you're helping the judge by referencing these cases, by shepherdizing your case. You're giving the judge the information that he or she would need, or the judge to be able to give to the jury, similar cases that show, hey, look, this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in this favor, this other court ruled this way, and you tell them how the circumstances apply. And you know, when you cite a specific court case, if you have something like Lexis Nexis or any one of many, many different legal softwares, you can go searching through the legal software and all the cases, and they have them online, and you can go find a chapter, paragraph, and verse that specifically applies to your situation. And so what happens is that as you're going through all of these different aspects of your case, you're now, as you're able to, shepherdizing each one of the issues, so that when it comes down to explaining what happened, what went wrong, and the fact that this law that they have, your pleading is unconstitutional, and so you reference Marbury versus Madison, 5 U.S. First Branch 137. And as you're referencing that, you reference 179 through 180, and what happens is that it comes down to the line and says, thus the particular phraseology of the Constitution of the United States confirms and strengthens the principle supposed to be essential to the written Constitution that a law repugnant to the Constitution is void, and that the courts, as well as all other departments, are bound by that instrument, and the rule must be discharged. So you told them exactly which case you were going to, the chapter, paragraph, and verse. Okay, and Marbury versus Madison just happens to be a very, very common one, that one of my favorites. That when we've got, something that has to deal with Homeland Security, They've got this Know Your Customer thing, you know, that they're requiring people to do investigations on individuals without probable cause. And so what's happening is that technically you're guilty until proven innocent. And, you know, showing that your money, the money that was in your pillowcase all these years or your mattress, now you're bringing it out. Now they want to justify where it's at and you can't, they don't allow you to spend it. Well, that's a deprivation of rights under color of law, under 18 U.S.C. 242, and that's a criminal act. It also violates the Fourth Amendment for due process. So what happens is that in certain cases, you will bring those items up and Marbury versus Madison to show that even a law can be unconstitutional and that the United States Code under 18 U.S.C. 242 and 42 U.S.C. 1983, and both those particular statutes are written very similar, except one's criminal and one's civil. They identify that that there are laws, policies, practices, procedures that are unconstitutional, and it says anyone who deprives anybody of their rights under color of law. And so what happens is that you may, in your shepherdization, go through the different places in your pleadings and identify which one of these are or are not constitutional, etc. And now that particular statute goes back to the 1800s. Okay, that's very, very important that the earlier the ruling goes back, there's two significant aspects of that. The earlier the ruling is, that means the closer it was to the founding fathers and the clearer it is on the concept of what the rights were at that time. And then the latest ruling, the most recent ones, is whatever is based on the current trends of law as what how they've decided to rule. So what happens is that at that particular time, as strange as that sounds, the stuff in the middle isn't near as significant in their minds and doesn't bear as much consideration as the earliest and the latest. So when you're going through and you're shepherdizing and you're doing your research and you do your web search, maybe you don't have LexisNexis or any of these others, or Westlaw. Maybe you're just doing it off the internet using your basic internet search engine. Well, you can do it that way, and that's legal, and that's you can find out a lot of information that way. Don't feel limited or that your hands are tied because you're not an attorney with a large budget and a lot of the resources like Westlaw or LexisNexis. Okay? And what happens is that you use those tools to help the judge sort out your case and your cause. As much as you can put in there as possible, and something that a lot of individuals fail to recognize is that at the same time, you're educating the other party. And the other party could be a defendant or just another person. And the other party could be the prosecutor that's coming against you in a criminal case. That what happens is that this is your chance to educate not just the judge, but the prosecutor and or the other party that might be there so that they may all this. If you can do a good enough job at educating them, they may slap their chin and say, whoa, wait a minute, this is wrong. We need to withdraw on this one, or we need to change our policy, or we need to change what we said, okay? So what happens is it's extremely important that you remember the power of what you are doing while you are shepherdizing and while you're pleading your case, okay? Now, there's some aspects of some cases that we here at Americans Restoring America have come across that have not been adjudicated yet. Some people say, well, how can that be, John? We've got 200 years, and how does it, we've never tripped over this in this particular fashion. Right now, we have multiple, we call them constitutional questions that are being raised, that one of them, including directly addressing the Treasury Department and the Internal Revenue Service. And to help them understand this, this constitutional question, the brief that we're preparing in support for the individuals is quite substantial. We're trying to help. I've had three Treasury agents say, you know what, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I don't know why I'm doing this anymore, because look at what you just put in front. What we're doing is wrong, and we you can't tax an income, because an income is a right, you know. And there was one case where the judge, the couple, they got into a dead spot in the trial, and they were they asked if I could appear amicus curiae. The judge says, you want somebody to appear amicus curiae? I thought you wanted them to hear to help you. He says, yes, Your Honor, it is amicus curiae, and it's very important. If there was a question or a concern that could possibly, and I had coached the couple through this 2 days ahead of time, which is, you know, that, and we gave the whole bio on the judge. Says, if there was something that could wash away your 11 years of law school, including your PhD from USC in law, that and your 37 years, 3 months and 6 days of tenure, and potentially put you in criminal harm's way of being prosecuted criminally, would that interest the court, this honorable court? And what happened was that the judge was so shocked at what, and the wife was the one that made that statement, not the husband. The husband let the wife make the statement. She played the helpless female being oppressed by the big, huge IRS flight swatter card real well. He said, okay, I'll allow it this time. They asked, could he appear electronically? And he says, the judge, the couple told me that the judge just about exploded. He says, boy, you guys are asking for a lot, you know. And they got me on the phone, and I appeared telephonically and was sworn in, you know. And I did the little short, the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among these the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are made and instituted among men by the governed. And the Ninth Amendment, the rights and privileges here within enumerated within this Constitution are meant not meant to disparage those already held by the people, which means that automatically it calls into question the 16th Amendment, the income tax. And then I says, if they have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that also means that they have the right to earn a living, to be able to feed themselves and buy clothing and pay for their children's school and support the government, etc. And if that right can be taxed so as that the proceeds of that right can be taken away, or the liberty can be taken away so that they can't earn a living, then is the right actually a right, or is the law being improperly applied? And literally, when I finished that 2 minute and 46 second dissertation there, the judge ruled in favor of the couple. And he's, and on the motion that they had made, and the Deputy Attorney General and the two attorneys for the IRS moved for a continuance. The judge was about to rule in their favor. They asked for an agreed to, they ended up with an agreed to order that they submitted before the judge, which meant that they, the individuals, the IRS agreed that this couple or their children or their children's children were required to file a 1040 ever again. And that all they had to do was show if they, somebody said you had to file an IRS, et cetera, file a 1099 or a W-2, et cetera. We gave them three orders for them to sign so that it didn't technically publish the fact that they were non-payers and were not required. But it was just any employer that if they went to go work for Burger King, Burger King says, well, you can't work here unless you have a W-2. There's a quarter that says this individual is not required to file a W-2. Anyone requesting it should consult with this U.S. District Court and check with the law clerk of this in this court number. And that's the way we did it. And they we were able to get them an agreed to, not just out of that 1 year's or actually 3 years of taxes that they were paying there, but we got them to the place where they, the Deputy Attorney General, both attorneys for the IRS, and the judge all recognized by the pleadings, we found a way to educate them in so that they could see the need to dismiss this and change the way they were doing business. If you can now, with now that you've shepherdized your concerns and your allegations and your complaints, you've got exhibits to support your testimony and evidence to support your claims in the exhibits. Now you summarize and you conclude. And what happens is that when you say, based on paragraph, page this, and our pleadings, and the aforementioned brief in support, and sometimes, you know, you'll make a brief in support of a specific point or the whole case, and that because certain courts only allow you to have, you can only file 20 pages or 25 pages. Some will only allow 15. Well, then what you do is you put all the extra testimony and evidence in a brief in support as an exhibit so that the original pleading is less than the 25 prescribed pages. The reason they do that is so that the judges aren't immortal. They don't have eternity to read your pleadings. And if you're, there are some pleadings, and I'll admit, there's some federal pleadings where we distilled them down to 6 pages, and so that it was very ABC, easy to read. And the two biggest paragraphs were, first, what in the front, what we were complaining about, and two, the conclusion and the prepare. On the our conclusion in the prayer, P-R-A-Y-E-R, so that you said, based on this, the aforementioned, the government has not been able to prove that this individual is a taxpayer, and there's nothing in the United States Code that identifies them as a taxpayer, and based on the constitutional question and challenge paragraph 4 on page 3, et cetera, and the brief in support of that, at this time, unless the government can prove otherwise that the couple is required to file a 1040 and pay taxes with the United States Code and showing how it does not contradict with their rights under the Declaration of Independence and Art and Amendment Number 9, we ask the Honorable Court to dismiss the Treasury Department's cause of action and enjoin them from any further attempts at requiring the defendant to file a 1040 or have withholding or pay taxes, and respectfully request damages equal to all of the filings that have been made and all the deposits and taxes that have been withheld for the last 7 years, and punitive damages in the amount of, in this particular case, $4 million to so that they don't do it again. Now, when you're looking for damages, there's different types of damages. There's compensatory damages, meaning they're compensating you for something. Hang on just a second. Excuse me, I had to cough. Compensatory damages, you're being compensated for some type of injury that you've already suffered. There's treble damages, meaning that they allow that three times the type of compensatory damages that you might be awarded to help cover some of what's occurred to you. Then there's punitive damages, meaning we're slapping your hand. Bad dog, bad boy, bad John. You did wrong, John. This is to make certain that you remember that you did wrong and so that you don't do it again. And the punitive damages, you can pretty much ask, well, one professor at law school back in the 70s, he made a comment, you can ask for the moon on that one. And sometimes you'll even get it. But what happens is that when you ask for those damages, that's part of your prayer and that's part of your closing and conclusion. You want to make certain that you ask for something that they can deliver. If you ask for the moon for damages, you and the judge and them, your other party, knows they can't deliver the moon. Ask for something, please, 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 that's within the range and the research of what you searched and researched, what they can physically provide, whatever their bond offers or whatever the insurance policy that they have for personal and property damage, you know, for their car. Make certain that you ask for something that's within the range of what you already researched, searched and researched, so that you know it's something that's deliverable. You don't want to go in and ask for something that absolutely cannot be delivered upon. You're never going to get it. And that doesn't do you or them any good. Okay? So, in closing, you have to prove that you served the other party, and that when you file this complaint, you go into it, maybe it's a IRS-style case, and you have to go into U.S. District Court, you file it with the court clerk, and then you get a summons or subpoena that says, hey, other party, whoever you are, and if it's a government agency, you also have to serve the U.S. Attorney General. You have 20 days Monday next to respond to this. Otherwise, this party can take a default judgment against you. And you not only serve the party, but you also, if you're the government, you serve the U.S. Attorney General's office, and depending, or the state attorney general's office, depending on if it's a state government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens is you have to give return service on that, meaning that you have to show by this company you had them served and the company had it signed for and that they certified. And many of the jurisdictions require that it be served by a separate party other than you. There are a few that will let you serve it. After the court case commences, when you make a motion or a pleading, you make a motion to have this evidence struck, you do the same thing. The whole, you put the style up there, comes now, John Michael Smith, and for the following good sufficient reasons, moves the court to strike this evidence from the other party's case, and for the following good and sufficient reasons, and you go through, and you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them what you told them, and then you summate in the closing of the motion and your prayer, and then that one, when you can certify that the other party was served, and that's the final act of completing that, either that case or the motion. The motion is like, every motion should be considered the equivalent of a mini case being filed. And if you adhere to these, to what has just been shared with you, you have a good start on possibly being successful at making your pleadings. With that, my time has come to a close. I want to thank you for the honor and the privilege of serving you and being able to share with you and doing what we can to help restore America and liberty to America. We're going to open it up for Q&A. And if you can refrain to the subject matter topic, that's wonderful. However, during the question and answer session, you're not required to remain to a subject matter topic. You're free to ask whatever questions you deem fit. With that, back to you, Martin, and back to you, Michael.
Oh, thank you so very much, Brother John. Thank you so very much. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. For those of you listening on Freedom's Radio, look to the center right of your monitor. You will see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side, empty. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or question. Underneath that rectangle, you see a place to put your name, some other requested information, and hit submit. When you hit submit, it pops up on my end, and I'll be happy to lend my voice to your comment or your question. And while we're waiting for this to populate, John, I just want to make a comment with regards to what you spoke about tonight, that when there are damages awarded for or against any government agency, state, federal, whatever, local, county, it's the taxpayer that has to bear the burden of the crimes that are committed by our public servants. It's a win-win situation for them in that they get to carry on their crime, if you would, their criminal actions, basically with impunity until somebody challenges them. 99% of the time, the challenge is lost. The 1% of the time that it wins that you're talking about here, when that win is paid to the damaged parties, it doesn't come out of the offending party's pocketbook. They don't go to jail unless you've got a 42-1983 or 18-242 in there or something like that. The burden is always placed back on the people. So I just wanted to make that comment. Again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. We have a live call tonight with John, and we need to have some respect or some questions brought up here. Let me check Freedom's Radio to see if anybody has come in on that. Hope to find some raised hands when I get back. I'll be just refreshing here at Freedom's Radio. Nobody's written in. Okay, John, this, no one has raised their hands.
Okay. Well,
I see Jim here and Charlie and Josh. Everybody here usually asks questions. I don't see. I guess they.
Well, you know, that can be one of two things, Michael. Either which is the hope of every the hopeful dynamic of every speaker is that hopefully we've adequately covered the topic and we did it in such a way that they were able to absorb and assimilate it, and we've been successful. Now, that's one possibility, why there's no questions. Now, the next possibility
They're all stewed. They're all stupefied, and we didn't dazzle them with brilliance. We baffled them, you know. And they're sitting there just stupefied, with an incapacity to generate a question. Or three, we've just broached a new subject matter that we've opened up some new horizons with the individuals, and they are still assimilating and starting to understand just what they've heard. And it may be a week or two before they start to generate questions on the subject matter topic. So with that,
you put everybody to sleep, and they're not hearing anything right now because they're sound asleep in La La Land.
Because yeah. I bored them to sleep, or hopefully not to death.
Right. We have Jim from Phoenix that has raised his hand. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. How's everybody doing?
Better than mortal human beings should be morally allowed to be, Jim. And that's in spite of how much fun we may really be having.
I asked that question for that response. Thank you, Brother John. Well, Brother John, handwrite notes quick enough to follow every detail that you covered. So would you be so kind as to repeat everything you just said in the past hour?
Hey, yeah, you want it backwards fast?
Can you do double time?
I have it recorded, Jim. Don't worry about it. We'll send you a copy of the recording if you like.
Anyway, yeah. At least wanted to say hi, Brother John. I hope all is well in your world, sir.
Actually, I am doing better. Jim is great. We got power back on Thursday, finally. I'm supposed to get my laptop back tomorrow. During the power outage, I had a hard drive crash, and I had a loaner laptop for a little while, but they're in the process of fixing my laptop. I'm supposed to get it back tomorrow, and I've just unbelievably blessed right now. It's 91 degrees outside, and I actually have air conditioning right now, and so it's I am in Fat City right now.
Well, that area where you're at, it's sure been hit hard.
Yeah, we it was actually 9 days before we could get out. Between the main substation, which is only 3.5 miles as the mole flies from where we live, there was 2.25 miles of power line and the poles that were just bent over like toothpicks. Huge trees that were down. The transformers were blown up, literally. They sparkied, arced, and kaboomed. We had trees, and we had stuff that was debris from some buildings that was thrown in the path of the roadways and couldn't get out where we were at. We lost all utilities, the internet, the power, etc. Was living off of generators the whole time, and bless their hearts, those things were dying. And it was luckily we had enough gas that we were able to get gasoline after Hurricane Beryl. We had able to feed our generators enough that we were able to, until we were able to finally get out on the day that I had less than 1 5-gallon jug of gas left. My son was able to drive 53 miles, coincidentally, on what he didn't have enough gas to get back home for, but to a gas station, a Bucky's gas station that was open, that was outside the corridor of the damage, and he filled up 16 of these 5-gallon jerry cans with gasoline, you know. And Jim, we've just been having way, way, way too much fun. And I kid you not, it's wonderful to have utilities and everything back. And I kid you not, I feel blessed and honored. I feel like I'm in Fat City right now because things were a little bit tough. We took some property damage. The whole section of walls was picked up and, shall we say, moved over a little ways. Oh, holy kitty litter, Batman. Boy, did we have... Today, I was outside working in the heat between the rain, finishing some of the electrical repairs. We took a teeny bit of electrical damage. We had some lightning strikes. The winds where we were at weren't that bad. They were under 100 miles an hour. We didn't get hit bad, not compared to some of the other places, but there's debris from people's property 2.5 miles away landed in our property, and that was carried by the storm, even though the winds were less than 100 miles an hour, and so we're talking about blessed. Oh, by the way, next week, for those of you listening, I will be having a surgery. My surgery is scheduled for 2:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday. Hopefully I'll be out of surgery, but and in recovery by the time the conference call should happen. But I may not be on next week. Just FYI. So if we have a recorded call next week, you know what happened.
Sure.
All right. Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. Charlie in Tulsa, come on down.
Yes, I think I'm unmuted, correct?
Say that again, mm-hmm. Charlie.
Okay, thank you. let's see, I'm not at my desk. I can't remember the terms, and I apologize, and you just dismiss this question if I can't give you no specifics. But, Michael, I've asked before about this corporations needing to declare, I forget what it's called, who your owner is, et cetera, by the end of the year. Do you have the terminology for that? But I know you had – I'm just wondering if John can weigh in on – what we're doing through the CRTs, if they are really immune to this regulation.
Yeah, are you referring to the law that went into effect January 1st, 2024 for limited liability companies?
I think all corporations.
Okay.
Is my understanding.
Yeah, there is an exemption. There's a whole list of exemptions. We covered this several times on the Wednesday night calls with Mr. Slevin. There are one of the 35 exemptions that they have is a non-taxable entity. I think it's number 27 on the exemption list. I can look at Evan as we're talking about this. But so what we've always recommended from day one is that when you get the limited liability company, that the managers of the LLC are two charitable religious trusts, which are non-taxable entities. And then that's the proper way to set it up. Copy? So you're accepted. It's an exception. Furthermore, two months ago or 3 months ago, I don't know if it was the Supreme Court or some court ruled that what they were asking for in the in that January 1st, in that ruling that it took effect January 1st, was it was unconstitutional. So it's a void matter anyways. But go ahead.
Thank you
for letting me jump in, John.
Yeah.
No, that's you've adequately covered that. At least, Charlie, does that sound like an acceptable coverage for your question, sir?
Well, if I could answer this, that case, from what I read, I think it was in Alabama maybe, where I don't have a handle on jurisdictions and all that, But then indeed the motion was, or the claim was, this is unconstitutional, but I don't think that had been necessarily settled. And when I say that, I'm thinking of it's a company, we can't think of their name right now, I can come up with it, in Arizona, I think they are, anyway, that is offering their services for people to, you know, file this form for their corporations, the Incs, the TCs, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that person who's, you know, got a large business, but anyway, said that, now, this is just his comment, that is not going to fly. It is, he wasn't relying on that. I'm feeling a little, I'm not sure I'm covered. I have a CRT, 2 or 3, and it would be nice to have something kind of in writing, you know, referencing that. I'm just not feeling real comfortable, to answer your question, John.
Okay. Then what we need to do is we need to just get you that information in writing so that that you do have your comfort levels. Comfort levels usually are akin to directly inverse to your ignorance and on a specific topic. If you don't know what you're doing, how can you possibly be at all comfortable? Does that make sense?
It does.
So, Charlie, what happens is that if I'm using a Swiss Army knife, but I'm not very skilled at knowing how to use it, I may not be comfortable with with that Swiss Army knife. So what happens is that we need to raise your level of academia to the point where you do understand how to use the Swiss Army knife so that you can go ahead and use it, you know. And so what we'll do is that let's arrange for an appointment in the next day or two with Michael to just recover the issues that you're just cussing and discussing right now on that, and make sure that you're fully comfortable with that. And if necessary, whether I participate in that call or not, you know, we might get Schlevens involved or Justice Beshears. And there's a lot of other assets. The other information providers, we may even get GW to weigh in on that one. The issues are that amongst the information providers, there is a tremendous pool of knowledge and wisdom and understanding that we can bring up to help answer your question.
That'd be great. I have not been on the Wednesday calls. It's all I can do to get on some I do. And I was glad you actually mentioned Hurricane Beryl, because although it was stated that this is a live call, well, the replays also say this is a live call, and there was no – I wasn't on when a date was mentioned.
I didn't know that. Okay.
So
I know what I can do. I can just call out the day's date in the future. That works.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that'd be good, and particularly before the Q&As, you know, again, you know, whatever, you know, today is, so that'd be great. What was I going to say? Mr. Slevin, obviously, if the LLCs, what he's identified probably is what I need, you know, kind of what's the code number, or, you know, what is he relying on? Because presumably that applies to all corporations. CRTs is what I'm concerned about, that I have through Bernie. So, because as was stated on this call, and I can send a replay of this, our, you know, coffee with Scott opinions, et cetera, But he mentioned it's really easy for Powers, the three-letter agency, to go to the each state and say, you know, since we have a, what do you call it, a registered agent, I guess, that registered agent would have our home address and details. And so the three-letter agency apparently can easily just go to the state and say, you know, tell us all the people that you have registered. And it's like, there I am. So.
Yeah. Yeah, let's make an appointment so that we can give you some quality time and directly address your concerns there and get you may have multiple questions there that might be best served by multiple information providers. So to that end, having a special call just for you, let's make the appointment with Michael, and let's get you taken care of. Okay,
that'd be great. And I, and obviously, I think applies to everybody with CRTs. So.
Oh but, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah.
So.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
I'll call you, Michael.
All righty. I'm sending you now the BOI, the small compliance, the compliance form that shows you the exemptions. So I'm sending it. It's already being loaded right now in my inbox.
Okay, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it may be.
All right, so I'm sending that.
Thank you for your question,
Charles. It's right for you right now. It's out in the air.
Okay. If it's not highlighted where I need to see, I'll ask you when we talk.
All right. Very good. Well, you should just print it out, and you'll find it and highlight it yourself. It's down there, number 17 or 23 or something like that in the exemptions.
Sure.
All right. Jim has come back to the call. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes. Good evening again, gentlemen. So, Brother John, I don't know if you've covered this in a prior Tuesday night call. I don't know that you've been live here for a period of time, but I'm kind of curious what your, if you could kind of break down the recent Chevron decision by the Supreme Court and how that might affect some of those people that are visiting the courtroom.
Much of the federal prosecutors and the term pandemonium, I don't think even begins to apply, Jim. Does everybody on this call know that you can log on to many of the jurisdictions that are out there in the courts and sit in on the court cases that are currently being heard, and most of the courts now, both civil and criminal, have a presence on the internet and a video link, and sometimes you need to call up the court and just ask them for specifically how do you get to your court. But I sat on one. I just logged on, and while I was working on some pleadings for someone else, I was listening to a New York State Court, Superior Court, the issue about that the statutes that they were trying to prosecute this couple for were actually policies that were generated within the Bureau of Land Management, and that all of a sudden it was bought up that this was covered, that whole policy was generated under the Chevron umbrella there. And holy kitty litter, Batman, you talk about pandemonium in the court. They recessed, and the judge demanded that this one go up to an upper court to be ruled on, because he, the aspect of that he did not have jurisdiction to rule on that, because it was now technically invalid. And so what's happening is that the couple actually, the judge made the couple and the prosecutor file a joint petition to U.S. District Court to have the matter addressed. And, Jim, don't worry, it's much worse than you think. most of these guys are having trouble figuring out which side of the coin they're looking at, whether they're looking at the heads or the tails. And it is not easy. And that Supreme Court ruling, excuse me, on two of the cases that I sat in, that it just turned out they happened to, the Chevron thing just happened to come up, and it was not anything direct. What happened was that they realized that one of them, that the judge, he was very bold. He says, you know what? Under the latest Supreme Court ruling, this is now unconstitutional. Therefore, I'm going to rule in favor of the defendant on this, and I'm going to overturn the previous decision. He overturned his own previous decision. So, Jim, yeah, pandemonium. Holy kitty litter, Batman.
So, if I understand that case correctly, that administrative agencies that are using policies to decide matters would be deemed to be unconstitutional because it has not it is not an act of Congress. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. Jim, can I stop you for a moment?
Sure.
Okay. Where did the know your customer policy come from? Is it written in the in the law and in the code from the Patriot Act, or was it something? Was it a policy that was generated internally?
I would say it was generated internally.
Right, you are so correct. One of those cases involves that exact, and Bank of America, BANA, is currently embroiled in that one because they have been holding, they currently have 300, as I understand, $354 billion worth of assets that have been frozen more than 90 days. Based on that policy.
Any of those mine?
Individuals' money.
Oh, any of those dollars mine?
Oh, any of those yours? I didn't check. I didn't ask. But that particular case, BANA is freaking out. Because there's now over a dozen individuals that have filed 42 U.S.C. 1983 complaints against BANA on that. And I know of your fondness for BANA.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are unfamiliar with, that's BANA, Bank America National Association.
Oh, that's, I thought it was Bank Against America.
Did he say that out loud? You know, oh. Michael, I think his lips were actually moving. You know, I know he says, yeah, no kidding. It's no joke. Yeah, there's right now in the flurry of this, I have not had the time to keep up with these cases. Some of these things, Jim, just are so fascinating. The possibilities of overturning what's going on is just amazing. It's exciting. You know, and so for to that end, for all of you on our call tonight, anything that, like Jim, that you may see float to the surface that brings some attention on this, look up the Chevron Act. You just do a regular web search on any one of your web browsers, and just take a look at that. And anything that you might see or might come float to the surface, please, please, please bring it up definitely on the Tuesday night call. And now next Tuesday, I may still be in recovery. And of course, then again, after surgery, I'm, until the anesthesia wears off, and I may be a little loopy, so I mean, even if I'm out of surgery, I may not be up for being on the call. But please table these points on these calls for all of our benefit. Jim, thank you very, very much. Was there anything else you had, Jim?
Oh, it just kind of comes to mind that, one of the issues that I've found myself, dealing with is when a plaintiff's attorney attempts to bring in a out-of-court or out-of-state witness, or both, for that matter, in a form of an affidavit where there's no reasonable opportunity to cross-examine that witness who is testifying as to the accuracy of certain bank records. And I'm wondering how the Chevron decision might help us overcome some of those challenges, which seem to get shot down repeatedly when we challenge whether or not that witness can be or should be stricken or excluded.
Objection, Your Honor, assumes facts are not in evidence and witness is not available for cross-examination. Move to strike affidavit.
So no mention of the Chevron case. There's
No. It's just had that one take place before the Chevron ruling, just 2.5 months ago, almost 3 months ago. A situation where I was up in Wisconsin. They were trying to take a church. Literally, they affidavits of individuals that were abroad in Europe, and I objected. It was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I objected. Assumes facts and customary not in evidence, and affiant is not available for cross-examination. Move to strike state's affidavit and entry into evidence. And the judge, she says, well, I'm inclined. I says, Your Honor, if I'll be happy to, and what I did was I reaffirmed in as tactful a way as I could. I says, Your Honor, the defense is pleased to withdraw their objection if the prosecution can produce the witness for cross-examination. And that was the way we handled it. And when I said that, the judge says, we're going to move to strike. And the prosecutor in this particular case was a female prosecutor. She was absolutely livid. She was certain that she had the case sewn up and that everything was, it was an end-all to end-all, all-in, all-action, done, all-action, free, free, free. Mm-hmm. And so, Jim, sometimes how you tactfully bring that up, they're very, very important. There is a way to bring that up. Never, ever, ever think that all is lost. Sometimes things that we think all is lost, we're mistaken. It's a misperception on our part. It's just, we need to figure out how to bring it to the top. In fact, there's a there's this other guy I know in Arizona that lost his house a while back, and I was working on an appeal for, or trying to figure out how to cover the appeal on that guy, and something just clean out of the blue came to the surface about 2 weeks ago on a possibility of a way to possibly resurrect that guy's deal consideration that was levied against him. At the moment, I don't have the wherewithal to act upon it, but it was nonetheless, I learned that maybe all was not lost in that particular case.
Fantastic. Well, that's,
you know, just, you know, well, but there's a, there you go.
Well, you know, our faith is in Christ, and we are bond servants to Him and Him alone, and we trust that.
Sick him, doggy.
We trust that.
Sick
he
him,
has,
doggy.
Yep. We trust that His glory will shine through all of this.
The boss is still boss. He's large and in charge. He's sovereign, and there aren't any other rules.
It's just an interesting way to get there. That's all.
Yep. Yeah, LA via Omaha. Yeah. Thank you, Jim, for your input this evening. Did you have anything else
for
this evening?
No, now. Although I would like to ask you a similar question as it relates to when a witness is confronted in, say, a jury, what the line of questioning might be like, but that sounds rather exhaustive. And I'm sure there's a line of questions that I could probably find from a little bird somewhere of questions that might be asked of the witness.
Okay.
If they produce one.
There's I'll tell you that there was another case that they did the same thing. And this one was an Ohio case, and it was an IRS, the Treasury Department case. And I'll tell you, they moved for a 3-day recess, and they got the Treasury agent that produced everything in court, and you know, to testify to that she had produced that report and those figures. Hang on, sir. However, when we cross-examined her as to the accuracy, she caved in. When we asked, did you include this deduction or that deduction? You made this compilation, you know, and she totally caved in. And that's one thing that when they're making assessments, the individuals, because this was an affidavit about the assessment and assessment by affidavit, when we finally got the judge, he was so hard nosed, and this that he would not let it go. He gave them a 3-day recess to Monday to be able to get her in court, and he was going to see this individual convicted no matter what, and they gave the prosecution every ounce of grace they possibly could. And but when it came down to producing the evidence herself, she was not able to do so. And so, Jim, Domancic's nice with a judge. It's from the King in heaven that he gets justice. Don't ever forget that. Okay. You take care of my honored brother.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Brother John.
All right. All right. You're welcome, Jim. Charlie, one more thing. Have you got your senior inbox yet? All right. And it's on page 4.
Yeah.
It's highlighted.
Okay. And thank you. And I have not been to my computer yet. Earlier today,
well,
I had
on page 4. It's on page 4.
And also, I just sent a text thinking you might see it. But anyway, I texted you yesterday. There's some replays I want to get. I reminded you. Did you see my text or email, or do I need to send it again?
I did. No, I saw it. I just need to get to it.
That's fine. Just wanted to check and see. Thank you.
I'll be glad when we have a certain event take place so I can have a secretary.
Yes,
I don't have somebody to blame.
Yeah, there we go.
Brother John, any final closing comments, sir?
Preparation to move forward into a court is everything. There's a lot of sayings, chance favors a prepared mind. There's all these, you know, what happens is that right now, though you're not at war, the tip of the spear best be sharp. Tonight is going to be one of many more efforts that we're going to try to at least scratch the surface, so that in the unkind event that you end up in litigation, whether it's a plaintiff or defendant, whether it's civil or criminal, that we want you to all be humbly proficient so that it's not as an unkind event as possible. And the way we're going to be successful, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And to that end, it is my honor and privilege to serve beside all of you at restoring liberty to America. Thank you. Back to you, Michael.
Sir. All right, thank you. Join us tomorrow night where we will have a replay of one of Mr. Slevin's calls regarding the limited liability company. And I want everyone on the call to understand something that's just absolutely critically important, and at least in my opinion it is. What we have assembled here under the umbrella that I refer to as, quote, the team, end quote, is every possible solution that could be manifest on behalf of yourselves to enjoy the position that our founding fathers put everything on the table for to see that you have. It has been eroded away from us through our own ignorance over the past 150 years easily, and that we let this vision, if you would, slip from our grasps for lack of knowledge. Now, are the tools there to have in place what our founding fathers envisioned? Absolutely. Correcting your political citizenship status, going into a position where you are either by birthright, you are your name, one of the sovereign, if you would. First definition of United States, go to your Black's Law, look for the first definition. I am Michael Edward, the name of a sovereign, occupying the position analogous to other sovereigns in the family of nations. That's because King George III he transferred his sovereignty to the American people, not to the government, but to the American people, who then created the government. The second definition are people that are subject to the United States. Subject is a very strong word in law. Look up subject in your law dictionary. And then the third is someone who is domiciled in one of the states of America under and by the Constitution, 1789, having constitutional rights. So there's three different definitions of the word United States. You in all likelihood apply two of them or one of them to you, maybe two of them like I do. But however, you're not subject to the United States unless you're a territorial citizen or a citizen of one of the states of the United States. Now, the states of the United States are different from the states of America. Do you know that? Okay, the Buck Act, 1940, created the states of the United States. And so these are the things that we have in place. You've got Justice Beshear, who shows you how to own nothing but control everything through the corporation soul, the charitable religious trust. You've got Mr. Slevin that shows you how to operate in commerce without a tax responsibility, and how to assemble all these things that we just talked about in your life in such a way you're untouchable, with the exception of committing a malum in se, a crime which is articulated in the scriptures. And then it's still a question of jurisdiction, what court can hold you accountable for that. So anything else, John, you want to say before I hang up?
Nope. Thank you.
Okay.
Once again.
And thank you, everyone. Till tomorrow night, be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.